Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So has Barbara Bird Bennett been paroled yet? D. Sharon Grant, is she available? Who's next up to be the head of the Chicago Public School System? I mean, the titular head, obviously the mayor is the head of the Chicago Public School System. Right. I know we pretend, we go through this pantomime where we pretend that the mayor's not in charge of the schools. We've done that for generations, but in fact, the mayor is in charge of the Chicago Public Schools. And being the superintendent of the Chicago Public Schools is sort of like being the governor. It's about a 50% chance you're going to go to jail, and if you don't, you probably should have. And so that's Miss Jackson, if you're nasty, telling us about her challenges.
So we've dealt with fiscal crisis, cuts, strikes, almost strikes, not one almost strike. There were multiple ones. So go back and check that. And then COVID definitely put a lot of things in perspective.
Yeah, that's because you're a patsy for the unions. That's why you've dealt with all that. And then Lori Lightfoot did her duty in reiterating what you just heard from Jackson.
Dr. Jackson has been a steady hand. She hasn't hesitated, dug in her heels, and took these challenges head on.
All right, so is she going to send you a postcard from Scottsdale, Amy?
Oh, who? Jess? Oh, she said she's staying. She's in it with us. She's a parent just like us.
Yeah.
She has a stepson who plays. He is a CPS student. Her daughter goes to a Catholic school. I'm not going to say which one. But she's, you know, she's just like you and I. It's her dream job. Dan, you know why she's really retiring?
Because she's maxed out her pension, and that's what people do in the public sector here. They like mark days off a calendar and then they cash out.
Yeah, not just COVID, not just CTU. She wants to spend more time with her family.
Right.
This was a dream job. Imagine being able to work and serve in the district that gave so much to you. You will not see me running another school district, but I will continue to devote my professional life to public education.
For it.
And I will continue to look for ways to lift up students and families who need us the most. Mm. But for now, my family is ready for me to spend more time with them. And until they are not, which is probably in 2 seconds because we're dealing with teenagers, I'll focus on that. I want to thank my...
Yeah, it takes 15 years or so before the family is ready to spend time with the mom.
Well, that was a follow-up question. Ms. Jackson, are they ready to spend time with you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, that's what she said. At least I'm spending more time. It sounded like she made the ground fertile for her to return home. So that's very considerate of her with respect to her kids.
But she's not running for office. I mean, she did.
Who cares? Well, she's so uninteresting. I know you're fascinated by these people. They are functionaries.
I'm not fascinated. She does have a remarkable story. She is an accomplished person. She did go to CPS.
I'm sorry. What did she accomplish?
She went to,
she became a teacher and then she became a functionary for the city government. So what?
She was a principal. She was an actual teacher in CPS, then a principal at Westinghouse High School.
So?
Well, that's more than like, well, who's that guy, the Jean-Claude guy that came, and Barbara Bird Bennett? What did they do?
Barbara Bird Bennett went to jail.
Yeah, she's still in jail.
Brizard was a functionary for the state. He's actually more pro-school choice than she is.
Okay.
She's a functionary of the central planning city government. At least Brizard was a sort of a tepid supporter of school choice, but he was just a toady for the mayor. What's she? A toady for the mayor. What's the difference?
But it doesn't matter who comes in or what she did because the CTU runs this place.
I thought she was accomplished. Which is it?
Well, I think that she is.
Based on what? Based on having
CPS parent, it's good to see somebody that
did your
went
kid
to
go
CPS
to Westinghouse?
Schools. No.
Do you know anything about how she was served as a principal? Do you know anything about her talent in the classroom? No. You would say, you ascribe status to a title that, frankly, is being undermined by people like Janice Jackson. And I'm it's remarkable to me that you could be in that cesspool, one of the worst school systems in the Western Hemisphere. Yeah. You could be in it this long and still be captivated by your overlords. These are people who are ruining children's lives.
I understand that, but it's not her. It's CTU.
Excuse me.
It is the CTU. What she could have done
ridiculous.
That she didn't do
is
not pay them.
That's an absurd statement. That is an absurd statement. The administration is an innocent bystander.
Or the CTU, they're thugs. Yes, they
the
refuse to go.
The administration, the people mm-hmm. in charge of the government, they're innocent in this.
No, they are guilty. She could have done more to get CTU back, high school teachers back last fall.
Oh, but, my God. Who cares if they come back? They come back and then they do what? Maleducate another generation of children? Do you pay any attention to the product from CPS for 50 years? This is remarkable.
My kids are doing very well in CPS.
And how about the other 350,000?
I can only control my own kids.
I'm not talking about controlling them. I'm asking, do you understand how
yes,
they're doing?
Yes, I do. I saw progress reports, too.
I'm not giving
yes.
any quarter to anyone about the Chicago public school system, which Bill Bennett said in the 80s, the Ku Klux Klan could not have designed a better system to disenfranchise minority children. And it's as true today as it was then. And anybody who wants to defend CPS, you come with me with the numbers and you tell me the stories. You come with me, whatever line of bull jive you want. I'm not tolerating it for 1 second. And I don't care if you ran 50 kids through CPS, because we know what CPS is, what it has been, and what it will continue to be. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
What the hell is wrong with people in Chicago? What the hell is wrong with you? You see this little dance that Lightfoot and Jackson do, and back slapping, just like the Irish Pauls of a bygone era.
She knows it's an atrocious system.
No,
that's why
doesn't.
She's leaving.
No, she
Janice
doesn't.
Jackson.
That's not what she said.
She's leaving. McDade is leaving. Arnie Riviera, they're all leaving. All three.
Why?
First, second, and third position, all out June 23rd.
I'm sorry, I thought she was a turnaround artist. Which is it?
She's smart enough to know that she can't deal with the CTU in the fall. They're not going to go back.
So she's a liar. And she's incompetent.
And she might run for school board.
And nobody can stand up to the Chicago Teachers Union. Whether it's a flunky, and that's what she is, or it's the mayor. And I'm sorry, there's somebody who deserves to be celebrated here. Clap when you see the applause sign.
I didn't clap.
What a joke.
So what would you like to say, a parting gift, or not a parting gift, or any words for Jesse Sharkey or Stacey Davis Gates?
Well, you know, to be honest, and I say this to people all the time. I know. No. Jesse, we have very productive conversations privately, extremely productive, and we agree on a lot of stuff. I wish they would say some of that stuff more publicly, but I also understand the way the world works. I learned that. I didn't know it prior to coming into mm-hmm. this space. And so my advice or my wish is that people just really focus on children.
I mean, it's just stunning to listen to that cant. We're just having a fun time here. Oh, you know, Jesse, he is a real ball buster at Stacey Davis Gates. She's a number. She's a doozy. But, you know, hey, we all play the game and we all get paid. And then another generation of kids wind up on the streets or unable to compete in society. But, you know. You know, I mean, we try. Yeah. We've had our times. We've had our moments, haven't we? Oh, this has been fun.
She got paid more than the Secretary of Education. She got a big check she's walking away from.
What a freaking joke. Yeah. How embarrassing you must be, anyone, to defend that system. How ignorant you must be to defend that system. And anybody in it in a position of authority, particularly on the administration side, The unions are what they are. You expect it from them. All these Neville Chamberlains on the administration side, oh, you know, CTU's the bad guy. Nothing they can do. Nothing they can do. They're in charge. Good grief. Lewis in the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Dan, you right. Good riddance. You know, the only thing she was good for was for the pipeline to prison. That's all they produce in there. You know, they under-resourced the schools, you know. They closed the schools, and the only thing they did, they left them out in the street. Now they don't have nothing. They don't even go to school now.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Lewis. Yeah, a lot of them weren't going to school before the pandemic. I mean, we act like the pandemic is what really decimated the quality of education in CPS. Are you kidding? Is that a joke? Unfortunately, the joke is on all these teenagers. What's the stat these days? I don't know. Is it one in eight, one in nine CPS graduates will go on to get a college degree by the time they're 25? Not that the college degree is the end-all, be-all, but it's one indication of the kind of student you're producing. What's the proficiency level, grade level, when it comes to reading and math? Tell me about the ACT scores. Oh, I know, that's racist. Okay, don't tell me about it. Just tell me about reading and math proficiency. You give me a metric and you tell me how CPS is doing. 325, maybe 350,000 kids. How's it going? Good? But Janice Jackson and every functionary, every flunky, every apparatchik before her, they're not responsible. No mayor's responsible. Jim and Crown Point.
You know, a lot of people become teachers because they have nothing else to do. They really don't know what to do. So they teach, but then they strive to get into administration because they don't like to be a teacher. So you have people running the systems that don't really know anything about education. It's amazing. I used to tutor kids back when I was a young man. You cannot believe these kids coming out of the Chicago public schools that can't read and write, add, and subtract.
Yes, I can. I can believe it. Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, I can believe it. You know why we can believe it? Because we've been talking about it for as long as I've been on the planet. But yet every day, every time there's an event or in a press conference, it's Groundhog Day. Forget everything that happened for 50 years, at least. Principal at Westinghouse. Oh, yeah. There's a school we want to replicate and scale, right? What, because Mark Aguirre went there? For goodness sakes.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And if two of the worst people in the world can't make it in marriage, then what's the chances for the rest of us? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. After a great deal of thought and a lot of work, Bill Gates said, Bill and Melinda have decided to part company after 27 years.
Aww. We have raised three incredible children and have built a foundation that works all over the world to enable all people to lead healthy, productive lives. We continue to share belief in that mission, and we'll continue to work together. Mm-hmm. But it's over.
Uh-huh.
And they released dueling statements, or not dueling statements, but similar statements, exactly the same statements on Twitter at the same time yesterday. Which one did you read? Are you in camp?
Wonderfully timed.
Yes.
They're a lot of fun, that couple. Bill and Melinda Gates. I love Melinda Gates in particular. I mean, they sort of suffer from the same hubris, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bill, because he was a great marketer and he got the better of IBM and along with a lot of talented people, built Microsoft and became the world's richest man for a time. He's an infectious disease expert.
Right, that's right.
There's nothing.
He told us we're going to need a booster shot soon, remember?
There's nothing he doesn't know. He tells us when we can get back to normal.
Yeah.
There's no humility there. Of course not. Because I'm rich, I'm smart at everything.
And I hate him for that. I despise him.
And Melinda Gates, I mean, She was 29 when they got married.
Yeah, they have three children together.
What has she done?
She married a rich man.
What does she know?
Well, she wrote a book now. Now, this is, you know, her book.
The hardest pieces for me to write were the most private parts of the book. Moments in our marriage where I was asking Bill for more equality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is the reason why they were on the Today Show, or she was, during the pandemic. You know, they suffered. They're just like me and you, Dan.
Both people can set the table and both people can do the microwaving and the cleaning up. And so we're trying to, again, continue to role model that in our house for our children.
Splitting cooking chores during the pandemic. Yeah.
Those two clips are a Why Dan Proft is Single. I submit them without comment.
We didn't even have to play the theme song. Why Dan Proft is Single. Yeah, so now we have two billionaires instead of one billionaire, yes. They're going to have to split his net worth because they've been married more than 12 years.
Well, there's no prenup, as I understand.
Right, so they're going to have to divide everything down the middle.
How do you do that?
I don't know.
How do you not have a prenup?
Don't they write songs about that? Like, we want prenup.
Let me tell you something. If Bill Gates isn't smart enough to get a prenup, then he's certainly not smart enough to provide advice and counsel to the world on infectious diseases, much less just about anything else. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. I do like, however, although he came out on the wrong side of it clearly, how he processed the decision to get married in the first place back some 27 years ago. After this is described in the Inside Bill's Brain Netflix hagiographic docuseries, which is, you know, just more propaganda, almost Obama style. After a year of dating, Melinda described how they reached a crossroads in their relationship. Bill had to make a decision. One day she walked into his bedroom. He was making a list on the board. He had a whiteboard, had the pros and cons of getting married.
Well, you know what that is? That's just hot foreplay right there, really.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing in the bedroom? Oh, you're doing that.
The pros
and cons of why I may and may not want to be with you, woman.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Boy, where do you begin with the cons and Melinda Gates? Ooh, yeah, real trophy wife there.
Okay, all right, easy now.
Bill in Cherville.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Boy, Bill Gates is like the poster boy. If he has a goal, gets a golden girl. And probably right now, there's some girl eyeing to get 1/4 of his other money after the divorce settlement. And, Dan, look at it this way. It falls in the category, why is Dan Proft still single?
No question about it. Thanks for the call, Bill. Don't forget, he's the 1% pledger, or 99% pledger, however they describe it. He's giving away 99% of his wealth. That's the pledge.
Yeah, and he's not.
He and Buffett and so forth. But just remember, you know, they've run something like $45 billion through the Gates Foundation. You can run a lot of money through the foundation to take care of your kids and anybody else you want to. Not to mention, 1% of $130 billion is $1.3 billion. So please don't be too concerned about the future Gateses of the world.
Well, they said Bill and Melinda Gates are not going to, they won't, their children are not going to inherit any family billions.
Well, then who is?
I don't know.
Yeah, they're lying. Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning. So now that his marriage has hit the blue screen of death,
yeah,
is he
right.
Just reboot, or is he going to go to Apple?
That's funny.
All right, Ralph. Keith and Kankakee.
Yeah, good morning. I heard Bill Gates owns more farmland in America than any other one person. And I just have to ask why. What is he up to? What does he know about farming?
Well, he knows about the scarcity of land, and he probably knows about the scarcity of fertile land. And thanks for the call, Keith. And he's, I don't know, probably doomsday prepping, a doomsday that will in part be brought on by the likes of Bill Gates of the world and the rest of his buddies at the World Economic Forum in Davos, right? Yeah.
A lot of similarities to the Pritzker family. Their daughters are both equestrians.
They're both gorgeous. Oh, the families are both very handsome families. Very attractive.
The one Pritzker, she's good looking. What am I get? Teddy.
That's the daughter.
The daughter, yeah. Yes.
Not the Teletubby that he's married to.
Okay, easy there now. No. Yeah, so the kids are 25, 21, and 18.
Is that off limits?
No, what? Pritzker's wife?
You can't, people's physical appearance now is off limits. You can't ridicule those two. You can't ridicule those two waddling down the street during a parade. You can't? Those weeblos. Well, actually, he does fall down because when he stands up, he breaks his leg. I know, it's a glandular problem. I got it. Don and McHenry.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, first, Dan, after that last segment, I want to make sure you find some time to go to your happy place.
Yes, I'm here now making fun of Pritzker.
There you go. There's your happy place. Well, with regards to Bill Gates pledging to give away 99% of his wealth, well, he's halfway there now because of this divorce. And I just thought if he just gets married a few more times in divorce, he could get there just that way.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. You're right. I mean, going through a few divorces, you'd be surprised how much money you could give away.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
And he's probably going to date somebody as old as his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
Like Cuomo does.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. He
or tries to.
Bill Gates is going to be back on the club scene in because
he can
Seattle.
Dance. Remember when he was on stage trying to dance? Oh,
uh-huh.
Yeah. That's a good look.
Yeah. Look out, downtown Seattle. Bill Gates shows up. Is the grunge scene still popular? Do you kids like the Pearl Jam?
Hey, can I buy you guys all a drink?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Bill Gates. I mean, but look at it. It's like Bezos and these dorks that make billions of dollars, which is most of them.
Yeah.
You know, most of them are social misfits.
Right. Well, they're nerdy.
And this is
but
how
Bill
Gates
tries to be cool and tell people, you know, to get vaccinated a third time.
Right.
Yeah, because he's part of the struggle.
Well, I mean, not to be, misogynistic here, you know, heavens to bid.
Yeah.
This is how they get run by their wives. They marry these leftist wives who think that they accomplish something by they're just as smart as their husbands who made the money, or they're just as, or they have the same, again, hubris of their husbands. That not only am I smart in the area my husband made money, I'm smart everywhere because I've got money, mm-hmm. right? And this is how you have the same thing that happens to institutions. It's the conquest theorem, right? If a organization is not explicitly conservative, it will drift left. And if you don't have any sort of moral foundation as a person, you'll drift left, especially because you're being pilloried every day by your wife to drift left. So the Bill Gates, Melinda Gates story is in part the same story you see play out in Naperville, in Hinsdale, in River Forest, on the North Shore. Now, there's a lot of pathetic male impersonators out there that didn't need any push from their ghastly pea hat wearing wives. But a lot of these guys just go along. They don't really have any moral foundation. They're just sort of like make money, live in a nice house, have a nice country club. But they get pushed left by their wives. So they embrace all these sorts of catastrophic public policy decisions, whether it's in the school system or more generally in society, because they just want to, you know, I just need to get Melinda off my back kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, their youngest daughter is 18 and about to go to college. So that's normally when people get divorced. If they've hung in that long, they wait until they do it for the kids, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
They stay in the marriage for the children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But she kind of looks like Caitlyn Jenner, his wife.
Yeah, it's a compliment.
No, I'm not. Well, no, I'm.
Yeah, it's a compliment. She looks like a dude. That's what you're saying. And I agree.
Is that bad?
Is that good?
Is this thing on?
I don't know. Would you like somebody to say, Amy looks like Caitlyn Jenner? Would you take that as a compliment?
I don't have man hands. Right.
So you would not take it as a
no,
compliment?
No, I would not take it as
That's
a compliment.
That's my point. So I want you to think about that during our time out.
Okay.
And that's another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, I like the Babylon Bee's take on the Gates divorce.
Yeah.
I have changed my mind and do not want a divorce from this amazing, handsome man, says glossy-eyed Melinda Gates after receiving vaccine.
Let me guess. She got the Moderna shot.
Yeah. It's just not bad. That won't be paper of record for our times. And, you know, you showed a bit of a compare contrast. I mean, just to close the loop on the Melinda Gates versus watching. Caitlyn Jenner.
Oh, wait, can they see this?
Okay. Yeah.
They look an awful lot alike. I mean, look at them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're both wearing the same orange
jumper.
Type of top jumper.
Yeah.
Because she's just like me and you. She wears a eunuch, a little dicky there on her.
Can you
underneath her sweater.
Yeah, she's very handsome. Can you, what did they say about Sarah Jessica Parker? Oh, that face looks like a foot.
Oh, a foot?
Her face is like a foot. That's sort of Melinda Gates. But put those Melinda Gates bites again, too. Just to let those wash over you of what kind of 27 years it's been for Bill. I mean, she's making me feel empathy towards Bill Gates, which is a difficult thing to do.
And this, I really think the COVID played a part, the lockdowns played a part, and their marriage.
Do you think they grew apart?
No, I think that when you're with each other, a lot of people got divorced during the pandemic, and they still are getting divorce. Attorneys are very busy right now, mostly with newlyweds, but also couples that have been together for decades, like Bill and Melinda Gates, because it's hard to be locked in with someone for that amount of time.
Both people can set the table and both people can do the microwaving and the cleaning up. And so we're trying to, again, continue to role model that in our house for our children.
Because they were locked in their house with their kids.
No, but this is more general. She's talking about I petitioning Bill for more equity in the relationship.
Right.
You're politicizing your marital relationship.
The hardest pieces for me to write were the most private parts of the book. Moments in our marriage where I was asking Bill for more equality.
So you write a book about your marriage just so you can virtue signal your politics to the world and encourage people to politicize their family life, too, because, you know, that's the one area of life that, at least for some people, hasn't been completely corrupted by politics. So Melinda Gates is in the business of corrupting that as well.
Yeah, and the book is titled, because I'm, you know, The Moment of Lift.
Is that the visit to the plastic surgeon for her?
When you lift up women, you lift up everybody, it says. Families, communities, entire countries. So in her book, she tells the stories of inspiring people that she's met through her work all over the world.
Oh, she's inspiring people.
Yes, she's lifting.
She's met
up.
Inspiring
she's
people, or
she is
inspiring.
Met and she is inspiring.
She is inspiring.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's a biography. I'll put it in it's a nice stocking stuffer, right?
Yeah, that I can get that in the fiction section, can I?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Boy, that's a Peyton of yours, your eldest son. He can really cook.
Yeah, that's a filet mignon. And
we get the Amy's leftovers from the night prior here.
Actually,
in the studio.
He actually made 3 steaks for you guys. I forgot about Mike Scott.
No, really?
I forgot about Mike. I'm so sorry.
Justin, Mike can get to have some of Justin.
That's what I said. I go, well, you try to take meat away from a guy who's hungry. Yeah, you can go do that. But yeah, it's a filet mignon and then it's a special rub, but I know that there's coffee involved in it.
It's very good. And, you know, I don't like leftovers or anything that has to be reheated normally. But no, this is very good.
Okay.
He should, why don't you just have him skip college and just stake him to a restaurant, open a restaurant.
I know.
Or, I mean, get a little experience.
Well, he worked at Zia's for a long time and I think that helped him.
He needs to start like stodging and, you know, get the you know, back of the office, back of the house experience.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's get going. Let's make some money here. all right. So I'm starting to appreciate why we've seen so many intel failures from the likes of the CIA. Have you seen this recruitment video that CIA has distributed? Take a listen to one of the examples.
I can wax eloquent on complex legal issues in English, while also belting Guayaquil de Mis Amores in Spanish. I can change a diaper with one hand and console a crying toddler with the other. I am a woman of color. I am a mom. I am a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. I am intersectional, but my existence is not a box-checking exercise. I am a walking declaration, a woman whose inflection does not rise at the end of her sentences, suggesting that a question has been asked. I did not sneak into CIA. My employment was not and is not the result of a fluke or slip through the cracks. I earned my way in, and I earned my way up the ranks of this organization. I am educated, qualified, and competent, and sometimes I struggle. I struggle feeling like I could do more, be more to my two sons, and I struggle leaving the office when I feel there's so much more to do. I used to struggle with imposter syndrome, but at 36, I refuse to internalize misguided patriarchal ideas of what a woman can or should be. I am tired of feeling like I'm supposed to apologize for the space I occupy rather than intoxicate people with my effort, my brilliance. I am proud of me, full stop. My parents left everything they knew and loved to expose me to opportunities they never had. Because of them, I stand here today a proud first-generation Latina and officer at CIA. I am unapologetically me. I want you to be unapologetically you, whoever you are. Know your worth. Command your space. Mija, you're worth it.
Oh, my God.
I am an intersectional cisgendered millennial. I am afraid. I am afraid I understand, as I said before, what's happening at CIA, how it's being rotted from the inside out. And I'm not just talking about during John Brennan's tenure. That was a recruitment ad for the CIA. I can change a diaper and
with one hand and console a crying toddler with the other. I am a cisgender. Cisgender, by the way, is a person who identifies with the sex that they were assigned to at birth. So yeah. I'm cisgender.
Right.
You're cisgender.
Right.
Get rid of that word.
She's also intersectional, though. And by the way, I'm an intersectional cisgender millennial. This is not a box checking exercise. You seem to be checking a lot of boxes for this not to be a box checking exercise.
You sure did. Imposter syndrome. I suffered from imposter syndrome.
Right.
What the heck is that?
She didn't feel like she belonged there, but now she does. And now we're fortunate, and those around her are fortunate to be, her words, intoxicated by her brilliance. We'll get to this at the bottom of the hour about confidence and competence and how the two are not synonymous. They're not synonyms, even though we often treat them as they are. Now do you understand what's happening everywhere? You think these are one-off stories we're telling? We're digging through the K-12 school systems in this country and college campuses to come up with a few stories to advance this idea that critical race theory and these identitarian Jacobins are afoot and pose a real and imminent threat to Western civilization. CIA put that out as a recruitment video. That's CIA's best and brightest. Somebody obsessed with, number one, herself, and number two, non-behavioral identitarian aspects of herself. I'm a Latina. I'm a millennial. I'm cisgendered. Uh-huh. I'm sorry. Isn't the CIA in the spy business?
Yeah, collecting foreign intelligence.
Did we hear anything about that? Did we hear anything that was other regarding? She is a perfect intersectional cisgender millennial in respect. She's like the cliche of one. I didn't hear anything about national security, honor to serve my country, honor to protect American families, honor to protect our assets in the field, to help political leaders make more informed decisions by gathering and analyzing foreign intel and so on and so forth. None of that. The job is just about you walking around Langley looking at your navel, apparently.
Such a selfish commercial. I mean, that's always a selfish recruiting tool. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I mean, I thought it was going to be bad under Biden, but I didn't think it was going to be this bad.
And since we're
what if our enemies see this, which you know they have?
They have real intel agencies that are not focused on their identity, that are focused on serving their overlords, lest they wind up disappeared in places like China and Russia. But okay. Since we're on the topic of the Jacobin purge, I wanted to get a couple more illustrations of this in. Disneyland's popular Snow White ride in California, under fire for its true love's kiss. The scene and the ride, which shows the prince kissing the sleeping princess. You know why?
Yeah, because he wakes her up.
No.
Why? That's part of the...
She's sleeping, therefore she did not consent to the kiss.
Come on. Are you serious?
Yeah. Yes. That is what's happening. Hey. The fictional kiss was given without Snow White's consent while she's asleep, which cannot possibly be true love if only one person knows it's happening. So how can you call that true love's kiss when she's sleeping and she didn't provide consent? And there were no attorneys present prior to that kiss being initiated.
Okay.
Seriously.
So now we have to get rid of the true love's kiss scene?
At the Disneyland. So
are we going to have to, oh my gosh, we're going to have to burn the book soon.
At the Snow White ride.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's promoting...
sexual assault.
Yeah, and patriarchal white male, patriarchal
woman,
right? Patriarchal culture and so forth. This one, and this is actually, in some respects, I guess, an encouraging story, but not that encouraging. Jeopardy. Last week, Jeopardy contestant Kelly Donahue, who's won 3 days, or at least as of this event, had won 3 days in a row. Put his index finger and his thumb together in an OK sign with three fingers extended during the show's introduction.
Yeah, like this, right?
Show like, hey, I've won 3 days in a row. And that was, of course, a gesture that resembled very closely a gesture that's been co-opted by white power groups.
But does he know that?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't
what
Kelly
he
knows. Donahue know?
It doesn't matter what he knows. And so there were actually people calling in and going taking to social media, of course, where they're safe, to challenge Jeopardy and to demand an apology from Mr. Donahue, who said, as I just described, he signaled number three because, he won the show 3 days in a row. He clarified his meaning on a Facebook post, but that didn't. That he was not sufficiently contrite. Most problematic to us as a contestant community is the fact that Kelly has not publicly apologized for the ramifications of the gesture he made. That was a group of former Jeopardy contestants who took to Facebook to demand his apology. He then posted a statement regretting the misunderstanding, condemning racism. But he still didn't apologize. And so
he said he was truly horrified that people thought he was making a, white supremacist symbol on his chest.
Yeah.
Because he tapped his chest like that.
Right. Regrettable. He regrets the misunderstanding. But since I'm not a white supremacist, I'm not going to apologize for an innocent gesture I made. Is essentially his position without stating it explicitly. This is just an innocent gesture on the Jeopardy game show. And so tell me again how we're just coming up with these extreme examples to offer a caricature of the culture that isn't really reflective of what's going on. No, it's going on. It's going on. Greg in Jefferson Park. Hey, Greg.
It's got the cow guy on. You need to have him... apologize for all the times he used 3 and 8 when he was standing on the trading floor for being him and the rest of the traders.
Yeah, right.
Stuff. You got that in the CIA woman making his ad. Do you notice what she said, I'm this, I'm. She said, I'm about 47 times. You know what? We're breeding a nation of victims, and it's ridiculous. You guys have a good one.
Thanks, Greg.
Selfish victims. I mean, can you... If you worked for the CIA and somebody asked you to make a commercial like that, I would, hell no. Heck no. No way in the world would I do that. embarrass your organization like that and your country? We look like a bunch of wimps.
Apparently the CIA is not embarrassed by this because they put it out as a recruitment ad.
Shame on them.
Tom in Deer Park.
Oh, first of all, yeah, the 3-8s on the trading floor, not sorry. As far as the wokeness, on the firearm forms, you've always had to fill, when you go to purchase a firearm, you had to fill out the federal form, Latino or non-Latino, whatever that means, and then 5 or 6 box ticks on what you deem your race to be. Mm-hmm. So, you better fill it out and keep your mouth shut, or you're not going to get your firearm, and there's no bureaucrat that's going to answer to. But now they added last year, or maybe a year before, for gender, male, female, or other. So you can push back at, if you go to an agriculture seminar or something, you can push back to the people running it. But good luck on that form. You want to make a joke, you're done. So enjoy.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Research shows that people remember radio ads with repetition. So to help you remember that Liberty Mutual Insurance Company customizes your home insurance so you only pay for what you need, here's a repetitive ad. Okay. Research shows that people remember radio ads with repetition. So to help you remember that Liberty Mutual Insurance Company customizes your home insurance so you only pay for what you need, here's a repetitive ad. Only pay for what you need at libertymutual.com.
Liberty, 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 liberty.
Hi, this is Joe Cordell with the law firm Cordell & Cordell. When the prospect of divorce becomes a reality, you need a partner that you can count on. If you're a man in this situation, consider contacting Cordell & Cordell. We've helped men navigate complex legal matters for 30 years.
Contact Cordell & Cordell to schedule an appointment with one of our firm's Chicagoland area attorneys online at CordellCordell.com. 4320 Winfield Road, Suite 200, Warrenville, Illinois, 60555.
All right. I take Balance of Nature every day, and so do Peyton and Eli and my mom. And why do we do it? Well, because we're not getting enough fruits and veggies on our own. The founder and creator of Balance of Nature, Dr. Howard, said 70% of the produce we buy ends up in the garbage. Great intention, but you never get to it. So that's where Balance of Nature comes in. 6 capsules, you're getting 10 servings of 31 different fruits and veggies. No preservatives, no dye, no, it's GMO, it's gluten-free. And the stories you hear on the station are real, folks. Those are not people out of Central Casting. They're satisfied, happy Balance of Nature customers. And you could be one, too. Call this number. 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751. Use discount code Chicago or go online to balanceofnature.com. Discount code Chicago.
Did you know regular routine maintenance on your roof is as important as changing the oil in your car? Without regularly scheduled maintenance, your roof system will begin to break down, costing you money sooner than you think. Protect your investment with a roof maintenance plan from Waukegan Roofing. A Waukegan Roofing roof maintenance plan will help extend the expected service life of a new or existing roof system, will satisfy manufacturer and warranty requirements for regular inspections and maintenance, will identify problem areas and provide real-time solutions before they become big-ticket items. Oh, and it will give you peace of mind. Sign for protection and peace of mind with a roof maintenance plan from Waukegan Roofing, because every building needs an exceptional mechanic for the roof. Call Waukegan Roofing today at 877-ROOF-201. That's 877-ROOF-201. Or visit us online at WaukeganRoofing.com. That's WaukeganRoofing.com. Waukegan Roofing. Installing roofs you can rely on since 1914.
Illinois licensee 104-000761.
All right, folks. How's your golf game? How's your golf game, Dan? Pretty good? Eh? Better? Worse? Yeah. You golfing today?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I hope so, because you have a golf outfit on.
Yeah, I need to work on some of my game.
All right, well,
pretty mediocre right now.
You have time, because Monday, June 28th at the Misswood Golf Club in Romeoville, that is where we are going to be holding our annual AM 560 golf outing, partnering once again with the 100 Club of Illinois. We help them; they help provide resources, financial support, access to training, and moral support to both the families of first responders killed in the line of duty and active duty first responders throughout the state of Illinois. Folks, it's your chance to back the blue. Now, it's $1,196, but that's divided by 4. That's your foursome. And with that, you get a full day of golf plus lunch and either breakfast or dinner. So book your tee time today. This is always a very fun event, but it always sells out. So do it today. Excuse me. 560theanswer.com/golf. Sponsored in part by Joe Cotton Ford, Remke's Garage, Mars Medical, Pop's Italian Beef and Sausage, and State Farm Insurance Agent Finney Rachel.
AM 560, The Answer.
You know, this is the problem. This is what we have to deal with on this show. I got a text regarding that CIA recruitment ad. It's not possible to change a diaper with one hand, at least not competently. Yeah.
Okay.
Says a white male who texted me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've changed diapers for years, and there is no way in the world to change a diaper with one hand.
Says the white privileged female. Hearing from a cisgendered intersectional millennial who knows better. So why don't you stop?
Who has imposter syndrome, which causes her great anxiety.
Stop your cultural appropriation.
I can't believe
and
that.
Focus on being intoxicated by her brilliance. By the way, there has been a push back against critical race theory. And what you heard in that recruitment video is just it's all conflict theory at its base. And that's just an illustration of it. And so there are lawsuits that are moving forward. There has been this missive sent to the Secretary of Education, Cardona, by a bunch of senators, including McConnell, critical of Black Lives Matter, which, by the way, just released a new set of demands.
Oh, BLM did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they got a new set of demands. We'll get to
them. I can't believe we haven't gone over them yet.
Yeah, we'll get to them. But McConnell and a bunch of senators pushing back, as governors like DeSantis are moving on critical race theory as critical race theory indoctrination in K-12. Now, Nicole Hannah-Jones was on CNN yesterday responding to the letter that specifically called the 1619 Project out, her project, and the whole critical race theory piece of it. She had this to say.
Because this is fundamentally a free speech issue. If you look at the rhetoric of Senator McConnell and of state legislators all across the country that are trying to get bills passed to prohibit the teaching of the 1619 Project, it's not about the facts of history. It's about trying to prohibit the teaching of ideas that they don't like. So I've been a little appalled by the silence of free speech advocates as these attempts to ban ideas from being taught in schools are being introduced all across the country. But in response to what he's saying, of course, there's no single line or argument in the 1619 Project that claims that this country is an evil country. And it's frankly a ridiculous assertion. If you read my opening essay on democracy in the 1619 Project, in fact, what I say is that despite everything that this country has done to Black Americans, that Black Americans have seen the worst of America and yet still believe in its best. I actually argue that Black people are the greatest democratizing force in this country. So, no, this isn't a project about trying to teach children that our country is evil, but it is a project trying to teach children the truth about what our country was based upon. And it's only in really confronting that truth. Slavery was foundational to the United States. After the slavery experienced 100 years of legalized discrimination against Black Americans. And those are simply the facts of our history. What Mitch McConnell and others like him want is for our children to get a propagandistic, nationalistic understanding of history that is not about facts, but it is about how they would want to pretend that our country is.
That is total sophistry. That is not the position of the 1619 Project. It is ahistorical. It has been, despite her Pulitzer Prize, has been roundly criticized, including by left-wing historians and academia for its historical inaccuracies. They are legion. I don't have time to go through them now, but we've gone through them before. So you can always rerun previous conversations we've had on the topic, or we'll get to it later in the show. But here's the thing they do. It's not about saying America is a racist country. It is. And this is just another classic instance of projection. We're suffering a restriction on our free speech rights. They're trying to prevent ideas they don't like or characterizations of history with which they don't agree into the classroom. That's not true. None of that's true. At the same time, she says, we're not saying America's a racist country. She and her acolytes are criticizing Biden and Harris for saying America's not a racist country. At the same time, they say America's not a racist country. Anything that is not consistent with their disposition, of which everything needs to be forced through a racial prism, a la the anti-racist demagogues like Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo. These are all fellow travelers to Nicole Hannah-Jones. That idea, that viewpoint is treated as racist, because if you're not, you know, being preemptively anti-racist, then you're being racist. If you're not on board with our curriculum, then you're racist. That's the same thing. She knows you can't get away with saying America is a racist country. People will turn off. So she says that's not what we're saying. And then she goes on to describe exactly what they're doing is to get to that same place through the back door, because they can't get through there. They can't get to there through the front door. Don't buy any of that. Don't buy any of that. By the way, on BLM's latest seven demands.
Oh, yes.
New round of seven demands. Defund the police, so on and so forth. Convict and ban Trump from future political office. Permanently ban Trump from all digital media platforms. The First Amendment crowd.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Free speech for everyone but Trump.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, this show isn't for everybody. If you're not interested in the truth, if you're not interested in having a conversation on the merits, then don't listen to this show.
On AM 560.
Because there's no place for you here.
The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so thinking about this question that I get all the time, you know, why do we have such terrible political leadership in Chicago and Illinois, for example? You know, and why can't we get good people to run? Isn't there anybody better than X? And so I pulled back this TED Talk from the not-too-distant past that I do not present as unalloyed truth. I don't agree with everything the professor has to say about this, but I think it's interesting, and it's an interesting topic of conversation, because he goes after the notion that there are many incompetent leaders, overwhelmingly male, in positions of authority, both public sector and private sector. Why do we select so many incompetent male leaders of our institutions in the West? Here's his thesis. His name, by the way, Tomas Chamora Permusic. He's a professor of organizational psychology at Columbia University and University College London. And again, here's the thesis.
The vast majority of leaders are male. But a bigger problem is the fact that most of these leaders are incompetent. Indeed, whether in business or politics, most leaders have very negative effects on their followers and subordinates, causing low levels of engagement, trust, and productivity, and high levels of burnout and stress. Just Google "my boss is" to see what most people think of their managers. And maybe, just maybe, feel a bit better about your manager.
There's a little bit of cheapness to this, right? I mean, of course, it's an applause line to just say, you know, men are incompetent. It's like the premise of every stupid sitcom on TV, right? Right. Men are idiots. Okay. But it's a little bit deeper
and
than that.
And
yeah. They're buffoons and they're incompetent.
Philanders.
But it goes deeper than that. You know, the cheap applause lines notwithstanding. So why? Why do we choose? Because again, this isn't, we're passive on the topic. We're innocent bystanders, whether in an organization or as an electorate. We're choosing. We're making these choices. So why are we making such bad choices? Three reasons. Number one.
The first is our inability to distinguish between confidence and competence. Anywhere in the world, we assume that confident people have more potential for leadership, but in any area of talent, including leadership, there is just very little overlap between confidence, how good people think they are at something, and competence, how good they actually are at something.
Yeah, and I would offer a friendly amendment to what he's talking about historically to present day and what we were just discussing before Mike Scott's newscast about that Humans of the CIA recruitment ad where it was all navel-gazing all the time, confusing confidence with competence. That CIA recruitment ad was all about, I'm confident in who I am as a person. I'm intoxicated by my own brilliance. I have this and I am that.
And I feel safe here.
What does that have to do with you being a competent CIA analyst?
Nothing.
Right.
Zilch.
So, that's a good illustration of it in the identitarian space, too. So this is not a left-right matter. Second reason, so number one, confusing confidence with competence. Number two, what leads us to make bad decisions?
The second reason is our love for charismatic individuals, particularly since the 1960s mass media explosion, but this has been turbocharged by the recent digital age. We appear to want leaders who are charming and entertaining, but there is a big difference between an effective leader and a stand-up comedian. In fact, the best leaders are humble rather than charismatic, to the point of even being rather boring.
Mm-hmm. And number three?
Our inability to resist the allure of narcissistic individuals. People with grandiose and megalomaniac visions that tap into our own narcissism. We've always admired famous people, but our admiration for people who admire themselves or are famous for, well, just being famous, has been rising for decades. At this rate, future generations will look back at Kim and Kanye and say, whoa, weren't they modest? Much of the popular advice that focuses on helping people become leaders nurtures and promotes a narcissistic mindset. Love yourself no matter what. Don't worry about what people think of you. If you think you're great, you are. Unfortunately, this creates a surplus of leaders who are unaware of their limitations and unjustifiably pleased with themselves. They see leadership as an entitlement and lack empathy and self-control, so they end up acting without integrity and indulging in reckless risks. In contrast, the best leaders manage to keep their narcissism in check. They care a lot about other people, including what they think of them, and spend a great deal of time worrying about their reputation, which is why there are very few scandals about them.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. So the three reasons why we're, according to Professor Premusich, why we're selecting so many bad leaders, mostly men. We confuse confidence with competence, our love for charismatic leaders, our inability to resist narcissistic individuals. But again, particularly in the latter, the third point that he was making, what did he say? Our inability to resist narcissistic leaders because they appeal to our own narcissism. You're not innocent. This isn't happening to you. I'm thinking about this more in a political context where, you know, everybody of age has a say as opposed to a corporate setting, but I'm sure the dynamic is similar. He's making the case that it actually is. The thing I would say, though, too, is point he makes about keep their narcissism in check, humble and so on and so forth, exercise restraint. Right. So what you're really talking about is character. So character does matter. And as some have long argued, character is ultimately destiny. So that foundation upon which somebody you're considering for a leadership position, the foundation on which they stand turns out to be really important. Not their necessarily their public bloviations, and this is not to exclude that. Of course, that's important too. But getting a sense of what is their foundation? Where are they coming from? Where is their base camp? That's what you should be trying to find out, it seems to me. Because his solution is all about character. And that character ensures that you don't get out over your skis thinking you have more skills than you actually have. It also leads you probably to lean on other talented people, bring talented people in, because you're not so territorial. You're not so afraid of bringing talent around you such that you'll be displaced. You recognize what you're good at. You recognize what you're not so good at. And you start to fill in the gaps of the things you're not good at. The solution.
So how then do we stop incompetent men from becoming leaders? The first solution is to follow the science and look for the qualities that make people better leaders, especially when they don't usually make people leaders. There is a pathological mismatch between the attributes that seduce us in a leader and those that are needed to be an effective leader. If we want to improve the performance of our leaders, we should start by focusing on the right traits. Instead of falling for people who are confident, narcissistic, and charismatic, we should promote people into leadership because of their competence, humility, and integrity. Incidentally, this...
Yeah, that's an applause line, obviously, but...
would also lead to a higher proportion of female than male leaders. As large-scale scientific studies show that women score higher than men on measures of competence, humility, and integrity. But the point is that we would significantly improve the quality of our leaders.
Mm-hmm. And so I would have stopped there and said, you know, I noticed that the applause was much more vociferous for more female leaders than it was for competence, humility, and integrity. Let me restate for all you simpletons in the audience. Who are just playing identity politics. This is about character. This is about qualities that you possess that are behavioral in orientation, not identitarian in orientation. You understand the difference? You mindless goofs. Yeah, women! Women over men!
That's so not what he's, insulting.
That's not what he's saying.
You want competence.
That's not what he's saying. Second, so competence, humility, integrity... The second thing he says is important too. Yeah, go with my gut. Don't.
The second solution is to distrust our instincts. Most of us love our intuition, but most people are just not as intuitive as they think. In that sense, intuition is a bit like sense of humor. 90% of people think they have a fantastic sense of humor. How many people are actually funny? 10%? One implication is to focus less on the impressions people make during job or media interviews, which are just an invitation to project our own biases and prejudices. Note that even when we have good intentions, it is not easy to overcome this. For example, unconscious bias training will rarely help you ignore that the person in front of you is white, female, or attractive. In fact, the more you try to suppress certain thoughts from your mind, the more prominent and present they become.
Yeah, so unconscious bias training, which is a favorite of the left. Right, we've talked about that being without scientific basis before, but there you go, he points this out. The intuition piece. See, this goes back to the navel gazing, the narcissistic piece, the I'm my own God, frankly. I've referenced this book before. Mary Carr, who is an English lit professor at Syracuse, her memoir, which is, I think, a bestseller, The Liar's Club. And one of the things she says in it, because she was a late convert to Christianity, is it took a long time for me to think just because it's in my head doesn't mean it's a good idea. Just because something popped in my head doesn't mean I should run with it. I need to bump my ideas against something that exists outside of me in terms of truth. Don't just trust my gut, what pops into my head. I'm a good person. I'm intoxicated by my own brilliance. So if I think something, it must be good because I'm good. Wrong. No. In summation,
is to not lower our standards when we select women, but to elevate them when we select male leaders. This means not asking women to behave more like incompetent men. For example, asking them to lean in, even when they don't have the talents to back it up, or spend more time on self-promotion or advancing their own personal interests. It also means not ruling out men because they lack the traditional masculine features that match our flawed leadership archetypes. To the extent that we can do this, we will end up with better leaders, but progress starts with each and one of us. If we want to improve the competence level of our leaders, we should first improve our own competence for judging and selecting leaders, especially when they are men.
Will and Skokie, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, you know, it's basically a concept. Democracy is based upon the majority rule. And we have this fallacy in our minds that the majority is right. The majority is not right, it's just the majority. And rather than sit down and look at our political leaders and various other leaders, too, I mean, I've worked in corporate America and I see it there, too, they choose based upon the factors that this gentleman was talking about, popularity and so on and so forth, as opposed to digging down and finding stuff out. So basically what our political, you know, elections become is nothing more than high school popularity contest for the prom queen.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call, Will. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, in other words, there are leaders who exhibit competence, humility, and integrity, both in the public and private sectors. So I know what is the prevailing approach and the prevailing outcome. And again, I'm not 100% with Professor Premusich here, but I think he makes a lot of interesting points that are relevant and that I do agree with. So it's, yes, this is what he's describing is not prevailing. What Will described is prevailing, but it doesn't have to be that way. But the key is here, because this is a real cultural problem, pointing to somebody and saying, yep, that's the problem. That person's terrible. And you are in a position to do something about it, but pretend you aren't. That innocent bystander syndrome. Much worse than the imposter syndrome.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Since our program's YouTube channel got suspended for a week by YouTube because we discussed the science of masks and mask wearing, we didn't just repeat the state/big tech sponsor propaganda. I say let's double down and see if we can get the whole station's YouTube channel suspended for a week.
Because you can still see us on AM 560, The Answer YouTube, but the Chicago's Morning Answer YouTube channel has been suspended for a week. Complete censorship, I think.
Well, let's go.
I mean, it's beyond that. This is again, we knew this was going to happen.
Well, let's go for two. Let's play two in the immortal words of Ernie Banks, and talk about the price that was paid by young and old alike for the lockdowns and the other responses to the pandemic. Very interesting piece. A way to quantify this rather than just sort of feel it out. Charles Hooper and David Henderson write in the Wall Street Journal. Henderson is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he was a senior health economist with Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors. Hooper is the president of a firm that consults with pharma clients. It's interesting what they did. They looked at young and old alike. The benefits of protecting the old and vulnerable exceed the costs. The costs of protecting the young and healthy have exceeded the benefits. And when they say protecting, they mean a voluntary as well as coercive precautions. So mask wearing, washing, quarantining, distancing, isolation of infected people, the whole gamut. Benefits of protecting the old and the vulnerable exceeded the costs. Costs of protecting the young and healthy exceeded the benefits. Let's put some numbers to it. They took an 18-year-old and an 85-year-old. If the 18-year-old dies, he loses 61.2 years of expected life. That's a lot. But the probability of the 18-year-old dying, if infected, is tiny, about 0.04%. So the expected years of life lost are only that times 35% because of the the reduction in risk times 61.2 years, which is 9/10,000ths of a year. That's only 7.5 hours. Everything this younger person has been through over the past year was to prevent, on average, the loss of 7.5 hours of his life. Now consider the 85-year-old. If he dies, he will lose 6.5 years of expected life, the probability of dying. If infected, it is much higher for him, about 8%. So the expected years of life lost are 8% times 35% times 6.4 years, which is 0.179th of a year, 65 days. The benefit of protection measured in life expectancy, 210 times higher for the 85-year-old as compared to the 18-year-old. 265 days versus 7.5 hours. What does that translate into? There was a study done by the OECD to estimate loss of lifetime income for students that was estimated to be 6%. Given U.S. median lifetime earnings of $1.7 million, that 6% translates into $102,000 per student. And of course, that loss is almost exclusively felt by the young, not the 18-year-old, not the 85-year-old. So the question, would you pay $102,000 to live an extra 7.5 years? What 18-year-old values his time at $13,600 an hour? The costs for the 85-year-old are close to zero. Person's probably retired, and the benefit is 65 days. Now, the authors point out, of course, there are other benefits to both groups and, in different risk portfolio, different risk tolerances and so forth. But it is a way to sort of get some sense of proportion here. What is the most likely scenario, and what are we doing in terms of providing benefit versus what are we imposing in terms of cost? And think of the cost that we've imposed on 18-year-olds, and this doesn't even get into sort of the psychological and other aspects of these lockdown policies that, as we've heard from many mental health professionals, may have quite the long tail, particularly for those that are pre-adolescent. The 85-year-old versus the 18-year-old, that sort of drill out, I think, is very helpful. For more on this topic, as well as a discussion of a favorite topic in Chicago, the outfit, Bill O'Reilly joins us. Bill O'Reilly, of course, was the iconic anchor of the O'Reilly Factor, and he is at BillO'Reilly.com now, followed by millions all over the world. His No Spin News is broadcast weekday nights, 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. on the First TV, which is a new media network available across digital platforms, including Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV, many others. And his O'Reilly Update is heard weekdays on more than 225 radio stations across the country and streamed on the Pandora app. And of course, everyone is familiar with his Killing series, his new installment in that series, Killing the Mob, the Fight Against Organized Crime in America. Bill, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me in, guys. How are you?
Good. So we'll get to the book in just a minute, but just your sort of global perspective on the last year of COVID policy.
Well, I think the contagion is vicious and has to be confronted by the governments. And whenever you have that circumstance, whenever governments have to confront anything, you're going to have massive screw-ups. I'm a historian, and sometimes things work out in the end, but it's always a botch. Revolutionary War, Civil War, World War One and Two. I mean, it's very, very hard for a huge bureaucracy to do anything effectively. So that's what you're seeing all around the world. And you know, to me, I tell my listeners and viewers, look, the thing is real. You could get it if you don't get vaxxed. I got vaxxed to protect myself, but also to protect others and to care for others who in my family got COVID. If I didn't have the vax, I couldn't have cared for them. So I think it's a common sense personal approach. I wouldn't depend on the government for anything. And then you get into the area of, well, how do I make a living if I own a restaurant and the government shuts down indoor dining? And that is a very, very terrible problem. So I spent some time in Florida looking at how Governor DeSantis, who I think will emerge from COVID as the most powerful politician, how they handled it down there. And they were the most common sense. That's what they brought to it. They said, look, we're not going to knock it all out, but we can't, as you just pointed out, hurt the majority of our people down here with draconian measures. We have to have some kind of balance, which they did, and then Florida came out ahead.
Did you focus on any schools at all, on the reopening of schools and sports down there?
Well, in my own life, I send my kids to private school because I don't like the public school system in New York, in particularly, that's where I am. And the private schools didn't shut down here at all.
That's great.
And, yeah, I mean, it was like they had to wear the mask. The urchins had to wear the masks. They had to distance. There were a few casualties as far as kids getting it, but not that many. Not certainly not enough to shut the schools down. And the irony of this is that the poorer kids, the kids with bad and derelict parents, of which there are legion, they didn't do anything at home. They didn't have the computer systems. There was nobody watching them. And so they got hosed big time. And they're going to be set back
years.
1-2 years.
And are still being hosed. Yeah, I mean, in New York and Chicago, still being hosed.
Chicago is a really good example of a city that is basically segmented between responsible and irresponsible. And that the government there, for decades, has not confronted the irresponsible. I think you guys would both agree with that statement.
No question.
Yeah.
No question.
Okay.
100%.
So I wrote a book called Killing the Mob, and it's an overview of organized crime. Part of the view, and this is why Chicagoans should read the book. The mob now is a lot different than it was in its heyday in the 1950s, early 1960s. They basically franchise out now. So the Italian gangsters, the mafia, all right, and you had a big guy in your town who was very, very powerful. They now retail it out. So the drugs, for example, which is, I'd say, 70% of all revenue for organized crime, they say to the neighborhood gangs, you can sell, but you got to pay us tribute a lot, and we'll let you sell on the street because the organized crime doesn't want to do that anymore. Well, that's what's causing all the murders in the poor neighborhoods of Chicago. These drug gangs, all right, fighting for turf or whatever they're for, and then innocent people are caught in the crossfire. Well, you're never going to get the politicians to confront that. They're not going to do that. And so, you know, it's a frustrating thing because they don't put it out for what it is. I mean, it's not like Chicagoans are running around killing everybody. It's the gangs that are doing it. And they're selling narcotics. But Lightfoot's not going to say that. And Emmanuel didn't say that. They just cover up the truth. And so the city of Chicago's got this big black mark on it, like everybody, well, I don't know, Chicago, I'm going to get shot. You're not going to get shot unless you go to those drug neighborhoods that are deprived and have been for centuries.
Right.
So it's really almost depressing. And my job is to tell the truth, which I do on my programs and in my books.
Well, with respect to your latest, Killing the Mob, as you were talking about, how much of the government horning in on the mob's action, legalizing some of the rackets, gambling, drug legalization in New York City, maybe prostitution legalization in the not too distant future, how much has that changed the landscape?
Not at all. It hasn't changed it at all, because the organized crime families, all right, the people that run the rackets, they call them, vice. The legalization of pot is not going to do anything to them, because the pot costs a lot more when you walk into the store and buy it than on the street. And so their business isn't going to go down. And hard drugs, in Oregon, they legalize hard drugs. You want to carry heroin and fentanyl around in your pocket? You can do that in Oregon. But that's not going to that's not going to mean anything to the organized crime people out in Oregon, because you got to get that drug in here. All right? And that's what they do. They forge an alliance with the Mexican cartels. Cartels smuggle it in. Organized crime takes it over, distributes it to the drug gangs, and that's how the addicts get it, and that's why you have a big opioid crisis. But again, the government's not going to tell you that. The reason that the mob was able to become the most powerful entity in the United States from 1946 to 1962 was because the federal government, in the form of the FBI, wouldn't investigate them. Nobody investigated organized crime from 1946 to 1962.
Why not?
And because they had stuff on J. Edgar Hoover. The mob had stuff on him. So, and Hoover wouldn't even acknowledge there was a mafia, when the mafia helped the United States invade Sicily. That's how they got so powerful. This is what the narrative that I have in Killing the Mob. I take it from John Dillinger, shot on the streets of Chicago, okay, in the 1930s, then to Al Capone, Chicago again, then all the way up to today. And there's an arc. But for 16 years, there were no federal investigations into organized crime. Therefore, organized crime took over the movie industry, the rock and roll industry, the nightclub industry, built a city, Las Vegas, ran a country, Cuba, and nobody investigated them. And they amassed unbelievable power. But then Bobby Kennedy came in and changed everything.
Well, didn't it start even before that with the Kefauver Commission starting to look at organized crime?
That was more of a political thing than a "we're going to send you to the penitentiary" thing.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, they did TV things in the 50s, got enormous ratings. Everybody watched. But these guys just, "well, I'm taking the Fifth. I'm going to, you know," it's like nobody got anywhere on it. It was only when Bobby Kennedy went in and used the power of the federal government to start to get indictments, and then they, after that, they passed the RICO law, and that really crippled organized crime. But they're still there, and they're still making a lot of money.
Yeah, I wanted to get your sense of just in the last 30 years, say, from Rudy Giuliani's prosecution of the five families under RICO, you know, the effect that had, and what the trajectory has been from that point, the 80s, until today. You know, what is the footprint of the mob today?
Well, that caused the mob to change their way of business. So narcotics is the big thing. When you watch the movie The Godfather, it was true that a lot of the families didn't want to get into the drug industry because they knew that this was going to cause a lot of aggression toward them. But a guy, you know, the mobsters finally said, "well, there's so much money in this that we have to do it." And so now, as I said, 70-75% of the revenue that goes into organized crime is narcotics. Because vice, it's just not much. Shakedowns, all of this, I mean, that they don't deal with that much anymore. They're in the unions big time. Mm-hmm. Organized crime still in the unions. In fact, I have a passage in my book on Donald Trump, the United States of Trump, where he tells me, the president actually said, "look, if I wanted to get a building put up in New York City, I had to deal with the concrete union, which is run by the mob out of Staten Island." Hmm. And I had them in my office, and I had to negotiate with them, or I couldn't build a building. That happens today. So the footprint today is unions, narcotics, and then betting to some extent. Sports betting is a big revenue generator.
It's interesting you bring up Trump, too, and the unions in particular, and the continuing influence, because, of course, there's a passage in Frank Sheeran's book that was optioned into a movie a couple of years ago, I Heard You Paint Houses, talking about how the Biden campaign and Joe Biden's first Senate run went to him, who was a Teamsters official, and wanted the paper in Delaware to not be distributed in advance of the election. And Frank Sheeran said, "we did Biden that favor, and we always had an audience with Joe Biden after that."
Well, I don't know anything particularly about Biden. I do know that Sheeran's book was not true.
Really?
And he wrote it because he was dying and he needed money, and he had to put in there, you know, what he thought would sell and the publisher wanted to hear. We have, I think, the best rundown of Jimmy Hoffa's death that has ever been put into print in Killing the Mob. I mean, it's a minute by minute. And we got it from their Hoffa family. So it's a very, you know, I mean, I understand showbiz and publishing, and I know you got to say a lot of stuff, but if you read Killing the Mob, we back up every single thing. No anonymous sources. All the names are there. This is what happened. This is how we know it happened. And you know, I write books that are very entertaining. The Killing series is the most successful nonfiction book series of all time.
And are you going to tell us where
copies.
Jimmy Hoffa's body is?
You gotta read.
Well,
the book.
They chopped them up.
Yeah,
and they chopped them up in Detroit, north of Detroit. So you know, when you get your body chopped up, you could be in a lot of places.
Yeah,
it's like that Johnny Cash song, "One Piece at a Time." Sort of, so it's kind of the same idea.
One of those.
Bill O'Reilly.
Go ahead, guys.
No, go ahead, Bill.
No, I was just saying, there's so many characters. I mean, it just so many characters. In the arc from Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger all the way to today. And you bring up Biden and I brought up Trump. Everybody that is in public life, whether you're an entertainer, an actor, a politician, a sports person, the two Ali Liston fights were thrown by Liston. He took dives in both fights. I mean, everybody crossed paths with these people. They'd be just that powerful.
Really interesting. Bill O'Reilly, host of the No Spin News, weeknights 5 p.m. Chicago time at BillO'Reilly.com. And the new book in the Killing series, Killing the Mob, The Fight Against Organized Crime in America. Bill, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys, anytime. Thanks for having me in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. He joined us on our Turnkey.pro answer line. Coming up on...
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Madigan runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank, gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Dan and Amy, and that intro music means it's time for our weekly hit with Ted Dabrowski. He's the president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org, a repository of all things policy-related in Illinois, public policy-related. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dan and Amy.
All morning, we were remembering the highlights from Janice Jackson's career as the CPS superintendent. I mean, there's so many to choose from, but please pick your favorite.
Well, I'll tell you her favorite. I won't even pick one. She said that she was very proud of opening the Office of Equity. And, you know, that, of course, we all know what that means as it relates to the critical race theory and things like that. And the reason I think it shouldn't be that is because, you know, the school district has been, you know, predominantly black or brown for a long time. And if anything, what really should have been done is how to improve results there. And I've looked at that over the decade, and you know, it's really sad how big the gaps are in what happens in education and CPS and you know, elsewhere. So it's you can open all the offices of equity you want, but until you focus on education, reading, math, you know, science, you're not going to get great results out of the kids there.
Well, just to that point, I looked up Westinghouse. Here's something you never hear anybody say. I'm trying to get my kid into Westinghouse. Westinghouse is where Miss Jackson was the principal before she was superintendent. It's ranked the 13th best high school in Chicago. Math proficiency, 41%. Reading proficiency, 40%. But graduation rate, 94%. That is such a great encapsulation of CPS for me. We're going to, oh, the graduation rates improved under Janice Jackson. So what does that mean? You're passing through people who can barely read. Well, they can't read or do math at grade level. They could barely do math and read at eighth grade level, but you're giving them a high school diploma to get them out of the system. And that's what we call progress in Chicago.
Yeah, that's precisely what we've covered, Dan, in the past, is that you see, and those are actually pretty good results at CPS. You know, you have the other schools that are far, far lower than that, and especially the bottom ones. You know, we did a review of some of them a couple of years ago. The ones that were, like, didn't even have 20% capacity, the schools were effectively empty. And I think on those, the average of their college readiness was something like 5%. So the situation is really sad, and I think that's the big issue, that CPS has gotten really good at doing the promotional pass of students. You know, in third grade, if they can't read, that's when, you know, you should have massive interaction and intervention right then. But instead, they do exactly what you said. They just promote them through. You know, Rahm Emanuel bragged about the increasing graduation rates, but the reality is that many of them are going to remedial. Those who do go to community college end up in remedial studies. And that's what has to be fixed, and that's what's broken.
It's not just Janice Jackson that's leaving, though. It's McDade, who I thought she was pretty effective. And then Arnie Riviera, they're all three top spots are leaving. And Mayor Lightfoot says she's hired a search firm of, you know, former teachers and superintendents to find the next CEO of CPS. But we want somebody with a backbone that will stand up to the teachers union.
Well, you know, but I think it got us focused on the wrong issue. It's not about CEOs. The place is, sadly, it's a morally bankrupt and fiscally bankrupt place. And, you know, until we talk about how we totally reimagine learning for black and brown kids and white kids in Chicago, until we think about a totally different model, it's just going to be the same thing, right? We just have CEOs come in. Some of them are corrupt. Some of them quit. Nothing changes.
I can't understand why there is not more public pushback, public defense of the tax credit scholarship program. Number one, we've seen parents get their kids out of the system when opportunities are available. I mean, Bob Mazakowski's Chicago Hope Academy is 90% minority student, too, like CPS. And, you know, they're on scholarship stuff. So those are minority families getting their kids out of the system into a school that's actually going to provide their child the opportunity to earn an education and get on to success in their life. And we know that the wait list for the magnet schools, the charter schools, is in the tens of thousands. And yet, as I understand it, the continuation of the tax credit scholarship program in Springfield, which is under targeting for effective elimination by Pritzker, and, of course, the teachers unions, is going to rise or fall with the trade unions. If the trade unions don't mobilize, then this thing goes down. If the trade unions can mobilize and put enough pressure on the Democrats to hold the line on the tax credit scholarship program, maybe even remove the sunset, that's where it rises or falls. But I see evidence of demand, but then I see no response when somebody's about to cut off the supply.
Well, the big problem, and you know, you've worked in this and so have I for a long time, that the big problem is that the system has done such a great job of making public education something to be revered. And so it's almost untouchable. They argue that if you do any kind of school choice program, if you do any kind of, empowering parents more to choose what's best for their kids, that is going to just suck the life out of the public schools, and that there's just too many people who've bought into that whole concept that they can't really hear empowerment and school choice. They don't hear that. They hear weakening public schools, and that's why the public doesn't know what to do with it, and that's why it's still weak. But you're absolutely right. I think the trade schools are key. There's a huge movement that needs to happen, and that's that you can have the trade schools. You can actually teach kids not just how to be well-educated, but also to be professionals, whether it's welding or plumbing. Or there's a great many trades that can happen that where people can be very successful, and that needs to be part of the whole school choice movement.
And maybe this is a bit naive on my part, but I'm all for the trade schools and the vocational schools, but I also have, I guess, a antiquated notion of education, not just at the post-secondary level either, which is in part it's to infuse character and give and help to shape young men and women as well-rounded individuals, as intellectually curious individuals, so they continue to learn throughout their life and have a thirst for learning, rather than just sort of institutions that drive them into a particular profession. That's all well and good, and that should be part of it, like I said. But that well-rounded liberal arts education is something that seems to be given short shrift these days, and I think that's a mistake.
Well, I agree with that, right? It's in the end, education for, you know, certainly my perspective, for young people is how to teach them to critically think. You mentioned being intellectually curious, very similar concepts, but they've got to be able to think, and that's the whole purpose of education, because if you can't think when you're older, you're kind of trapped, you know, you're trapped in whatever life you're in, and you can't grow out of it. So that's a key.
There's a study out from the National Bureau of Economic Research on working from home, and one of the things they find, now this has not been peer-reviewed yet, but, you know, yeah, this is something that they seem to be indicating is directionally happening. A shift to working from home will directly reduce spending in major city centers by at least 5 to 10% relative to pre-pandemic situation. It also suggests there'll be an increase in productivity in part because of the lack of a need to commute. But the pre-pandemic spending, that's on the private side, on the individual side. So here again, we're trying to get a handle on what big cities like Chicago are going to look like coming out of this pandemic as we slowly reopen. And by the way, that's what we're doing, slowly reopening. All of this hoopla
today. But we'll never
today,
get back to normal, Carl.
All this hoopla today about Chicago reopening is just that. We're not reopening. This is incremental. This is a snail-like pace. But nonetheless, thinking about it long-term, where we expect, I think a lot of people expect some snapback, particularly while the weather's nice, and the indications are not so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly will be a snapback, but, you know, the question is, you know, how short is it compared to what it used to be? And, you know, what I think people forget is that this whole time that revenues are down, all the debts, all the liabilities that a place like Chicago has continue to grow, right? They, you know, Chicago hasn't let off, you know, hasn't reduced its workforce at all, hasn't cut any costs, and all those things continue to accrue at big levels. And so that's what I think a lot of politicians don't think about. And, you know, it's the same thing happening, by the way, in every single city in the state. And so those costs are accruing, the revenues are going to be weaker, and to sustain what we had, right, and population is not growing, to sustain those debts and just to keep functioning, you've got to have, one, you know, lots of revenues, and two, you need to have a growing population. And when you have neither one of those, the crisis just keeps building up in the background.
Ted Dabrowski, President of Wirepoints.org, all things Illinois public policy related. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Their call for unity is a joke.
News.
Important question is not whether you're right or they're right, but why we shouldn't have the right to flip the channel.
Fuels. Opinion.
We have got to stop making it a crime to be a Republican.
News. Opinion. Insight. On AM 560. The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And Amy, do you want to know what $90 million in Fortune 500 indulgences purchases?
Sure.
All right. It purchases these seven newly conceived and published demands of Black Lives Matter, the Marxist organization, Black Lives Matter. I'm not saying that. Alicia Garza and Patrice Cullors are saying that, the co-founders. Very Trump-oriented, the seven. Convict and ban Trump from future political office. Also permanently ban Trump from all digital media platforms.
Well, Facebook is deciding today whether or not he could come back in.
You know, why give up a whipping boy that serves you so well,
right?
I suppose that's their perspective.
They wanted him gone, but they won't leave him alone.
Expel Republican members of Congress who attempted to overturn the election and incited a white supremacist attack.
Oh, God.
So that would be, you know, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, they got to go. Launch a full investigation into the ties between white supremacy and the Capitol Police, law enforcement, and the military. Mm-hmm. Defund police. And also defund police more. Pass the BREATHE Act. And listen to this statement underneath their proposal to pass the BREATHE Act, their rationale. The police were born out of slave patrols. We cannot reform an institution built on white supremacy. And then, you know, add your name to the list, and then they'll send that over to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and Cori Bush will author up some legislation, and we'll continue to prosecute the case and provide no quarter to anybody who would seek to compromise with these white supremacists, meaning people who disagree with us. And it calls to mind a passage from Dan Henninger's most recent piece in the Wall Street Journal. Why should the left, whether in the streets, in the corporate boardrooms, or at the highest levels of American government, abandon a strategy of refusing to negotiate? It's working. Everywhere today, the opposition is being overrun or intimidated into silence. Right. So why not just keep issuing nuanced lists of demands and then just say, do it? That's we want this done, and we will accept nothing other than full compliance with our demands. Why shouldn't they take that posture? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Dan Henninger, deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. Dan, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Good with you, Dan.
And the Black Lives Matter folks and, others of their ideological ilk seem to get this very well. And Joe Biden seems to be serving as they anticipated he would serve. So why would this paradigm change over the next 2 or 4 years?
Yeah, I don't see it changing very much at all. I mean, as we know, the Democratic left, the progressives, have gained control of the Democratic Party and indeed the White House. And it is an article of faith among the left that Barack Obama, when he became president, tried to negotiate with Republicans over his $800 billion stimulus bill and then the Affordable Care Act, and he got very little. And the left believes that Obama made a huge strategic mistake by negotiating with the Republicans. They don't do negotiations. When you think about it, this is a hallmark of the left. It goes back a long time, Dan. I recall that back in the 1960s, you had student strikes, protests, and they created something they called the non-negotiable demand back in the 1960s when they were occupying the offices of university presidents. And that's when this negotiating tactic began. You don't negotiate with the other side. You just beat them down until they run up the white flag and give in. And if you look over the last year, starting with the post-George Floyd protests across America, many of which turned violent, we had this explosion of woke politics. Much of it joined by institutional leaders, whether arts institutions, CEOs, all kind of saluting the Black Lives Matter woke agenda. We're winning. And fast forward to this year, Joe Biden, President Biden, puts up this COVID stimulus relief bill, and 12 or 10, I guess it was, Republican senators go up to the White House and negotiate with them and got nothing. He basically showed them the door. Mm-hmm. Jen Psaki saying he's always willing to hear people, but she didn't say he's willing to negotiate. And I think that's the strategy that Joe Biden, this lifelong member of the U.S. Senate, has adopted. He doesn't do real deals with the opposition. And although there are some who think they're going to get some on that infrastructure bill, I think Joe Biden is pretty much truly aligned with the progressive left now and pushing back against the idea of doing deals. He wants to just force his opposition to come to terms with his proposals.
Meanwhile, the tab for all these plans are going to hit $6 trillion. And I mean, I don't know about you, but price of gas is going up where we live, and groceries are the prices of groceries, everything, you name it, is skyrocketing right now.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, and I raised the question at the end of my column of whether Joe Biden may not want to negotiate with Senate Republicans, but he's going to have to negotiate all this with the American people, the voters, come next year's midterm elections. And what are they thinking about all this? And I think many of them are reacting exactly as you described. I mean, he has just, with his American Families Act, proposed at least four new major entitlements, free pre-K education, paid leave, child care provided by the federal government, 2-3 years of community college. Then he says this will all be paid for by raising the corporate tax and taxing the 1%. I mean, how naive does he think the American people are to believe that you're going to support all of these entitlements at a time when most Americans do understand that Medicare and the Social Security Trust Fund are running out of money? So I think it's a very, very good question whether this strategy is going to survive through next year's elections. And I should point out that I just read this morning the Republicans have expanded their target list for House seats to 56 races. I mean, they feel they've really got an opportunity now to take back the House and produce a major majority November of next year. And I think that's a quite, quite plausible strategy given what the Biden White House has been doing.
Well, given the landscape you're describing, does, and even though he got, I think, deserved high marks for his response to Joe Biden's non-State of the Union speech last week, does Senator Tim Scott and do Republicans make a mistake when they trot out the same sort of canned lines you hear from Joe Biden about bipartisanship and we're willing to talk, we're willing to be bipartisan, we want to reach compromise? Not saying we want to be strident, of course, but rather by saying, understand what he's doing. And we have an alternative vision for where to take this country. I mean, the things he's doing are problematic in these ways, and this is the path that we want to chart. And, you know, the American people, you're going to have to make a choice here, framing the choice rather than trying to sort of middle the issue by using his same rhetoric, knowing that you're going to be at the same impasse.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. They are not, I mean, I agree. Yes, they cannot simply be recalcitrant and walk away from the table. I think the Republicans do have to show that they are willing to sit down and perform politics with the White House. On the other hand, it is crucially important that you're suggesting that they distinguish themselves with a set of principles that are identifiably conservative or Republican. And in a way, the White House, the Biden White House has handed them this opportunity with this extraordinary American Families Act, which is indeed a cradle-to-grave proposition. Democrats have elevated something they've wanted to do for a very long time, and that is to simply provide benign paternalism to the American people from the time they're born to the time they retire. And if it's basically a kind of alternative vision of the American dream. I mean, people think this is a land of opportunity. It's a land of striving, that you can get ahead on your own efforts. And the Democrats are essentially arguing that because of the nature of the modern economy, we have to give up, throw in the towel, let the government take care of us. It seems to me there's an opportunity in there for Republican candidates to make a very strong argument on behalf of the idea of America that I believe most Americans feel is the reason they are in this country.
I want to get your reaction to the news out today that New York, New Jersey, Connecticut looking to relax, rescind most of their COVID regulations as of May 19th. We've got a press conference in Illinois today with sort of a reopen Chicago, reopen Illinois. Of course, it's
The top
line belies the speed at which the reopening is occurring, of course. But the posture of the Biden administration vis-a-vis what's happening at the state level, where even the most ardent lockdown enthusiasts feel the need to loosen their grip. And yet Joe Biden and Jen Psaki are still clinging to their July 4th barbecue with a few family members threshold.
Yeah, I think that certainly the dam is breaking on that question of whether it's time to loosen up or not. You can feel it. I mean, up here in New York City, and people have been loyally wearing their masks, but you can see maybe 25-30% of the people out on the street no longer are. They just can't take it anymore. And I do think that the White House is getting itself off on the wrong side of this issue, especially with that CDC of theirs. putting out directives and guidances that no one can make sense of or that change from one day to the next. No one's going to go along with that, Dan. They're just not going to buy it anymore. And if you have even New Jersey and New York under Andrew Cuomo deciding they're going to finally open their states, I think they've been forced to. I mean, these states are suffering. New York City is in a bad way. There's no question about it. And there has been an out-migration of residents from New York and New Jersey in the past year. And those states that more or less remained open, like Florida and Texas, are gaining people who've been moving down there to get away from what happened up here. And so the northern states, Illinois, including Illinois, Michigan, I think really put themselves at a tipping point. And they do understand now that they've got to open up and allow a return to normalcy, or they're really going to lose their states if they don't do that.
And what do you make of President Biden? I mean, he's still wearing a mask, even though he's vaccinated, and the CDC new guidelines say you don't have to wear one outside, even if you're vaccinated or unvaccinated, yet he still persists on wearing one.
Yeah, and the Democrats, the liberals, are just so attached to the idea of that mask being on one's face. And I do think it's a political miscalculation at this point. People have been wearing those masks for a year, and doing so, in the least in the North, very loyally. It's hard to function with a mask. It's hard to talk to people if you're standing in front of them. And they've just worn out their welcome. And if the president, the White House, Jen Psaki, or the CDC would give some clear guidelines, yes, if you're in a crowded room or something, maybe for a while you want to keep wearing a mask. But the idea that when the president stands up there by himself with hardly anybody around him has to continue wearing that mask, I think it's just striking a lot of Americans as the wrong message at this point in time.
He is Dan Henninger, deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. Do check out his most recent piece, Joe Biden's Art of the Non-Deal. Dan, thanks as always. Appreciate your time.
Great to talk to you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, took a couple calls in reaction to our conversation with the Wall Street Journal's Dan Henninger. Holly in St. Louis.
Hey, good morning, you two. I want to declare the person I detest the most in politics is Paul Ryan. I hope that there's a new brand of Washington General, aka GOP youngsters, who are watching these Democrats work when they have a majority in either the House or the Senate. They roll in like a steamroller, whereas opposed to when Trump rode in and we had the Senate and the House, Paul Ryan spent 2 years tapping the brakes, negotiating, and holding everything up. I am sick of being on the Washington Generals, and I hope that there's some young whippersnapper GOPers who are going, aha, this is how you do it. When you roll into town with the majorities, you use that capital.
Vote your shares, right? All right, thanks for the call, Holly. Bob in Edison Park.
God bless Holly, because she's echoing my points to a T. And what I would like to say to go off of what she said about the Republicans just being pathetic and weak, even when they have the majority, is I think even you guys call them out enough. I think on the Rush Limbaugh show, I think Rush got it too late. The Republicans should have been called out 10 years ago for absolutely doing nothing. And I think the focus now on victory should not be on Black Lives Matter and the schools and the unions. It should be on solidifying what we are, going on a 2 or 3 point message and moving with passion, because the Republicans now, they are just all over the map. Like she said, in the touch it one more time, you had the majority. Okay. You had everything, the presidency, the House and the Senate. And you did. Where was health care? You geniuses with your great business models and your Ayn Rand reading list. Where were you? What did you have? You had nothing.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob. Appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And among Illinois' ignominious distinctions, abortion dumping ground in the Midwest, there's legislation kicking around in Springfield just to do just what we were talking about is happening at the federal level. Dem socialists have the majority, then they vote their shares and they move their agenda. When they have the supermajority, as they do in Illinois, they do the same thing, as we're seeing. House Bill 1797, sponsored by a suburban Democrat socialist, Anna Moeller out of Elgin. Congratulations, Elgin. And Senate Bill 2190 would repeal the Parental Notice of Abortion Act. So there would be no parental notification if a minor child, a minor girl, sought an abortion. Something that's supported by a supermajority of Illinois residents, but of course the Republicans are afraid to talk about moral and cultural issues, so there's never a debate on those issues, and so people don't vote those issues. Among the testimony that has been given in opposition to this repeal is Dr. Brooke Bellow. She is a victim of sexual assault as a minor. She was victimized. She was trafficked, actually, as she describes. Here's some of the testimony she gave to our illustrious Illinois legislators.
Why wouldn't someone, unless it's an emancipated youth, why wouldn't someone give the opportunity for that youth's parents to be notified? How can a parent absolutely raise and guide their child? Why would someone want to keep such a profound thing that affects the womb health, the life through that throughout that child's life, keep such a profound secret? I mean, I was raped at 11 years old. I started being trafficked as a young teen. Our traffickers made us get abortions. Had my parent been notified, my mother would have known what city I was in. She would have known what street I possibly would have been near. She could have contacted law enforcement. And then the mitigation of the issues I suffered my entire life being happily married, not just the issues with endometriosis and other aspects of womb health, but because I was so young, my doctor, even as an actor with really good insurance at a young age, didn't understand that I had issues related to previous abortion. It wasn't until later in life that my gynecologist said, oh my God, what happened to you when you were young? Had you had any abortions? And when I expressed I had abortions, it was one doctor that said, this is why you've been trying to have children for years and have had miscarriage after miscarriage after miscarriage and other issues with my health related to that. And so we have to notify parents, not just because of trafficking, but a young girl could have been date raped, raped, traffic, the grooming process, all the different fears that a trafficker puts inside of her head to say, now you can't go home because you're pregnant. You know that many, many, many victims that we serve at More to Life have had to have abortions. And all I ever wanted was to be loved, to be married, to have three children before I was trafficked. I knew that I was going to have three kids. And they're in heaven. I've had so many miscarriages. I'm sure I have many, many children. And so I ask the public and I ask the Illinois legislature, why would you want a child to keep something secret that's going to affect the rest of her life?
That's a great question, isn't it? Why would you? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Mary Fiorito, who's spokesperson for Parents for the Protection of Girls. Mary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, Dan, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Bellow's powerful personal testimony. Why would you want a child to keep something that will affect them for the rest of their life a secret? Boy, do you get an answer from the sponsors of this repeal legislation or others who are supporting it?
You know, it's interesting, Dan. I was listening to you and Amy earlier this morning. We were talking about, you know, the poll that the Chicago Teachers Union has and the way in which they are, at the expense of children, able to get whatever they want. And, you know, the abortion lobbying arm in the state of Illinois in particular, also very wealthy, also very powerful, you know, they seem to be able to get whatever legislation they want. We saw that 2 years ago with HB 40 and the other Illinois abortion legislation that was sort of rammed through against the will of the people. As you pointed out, supermajority of people in the state of Illinois, parents poll in March, showed 72% of people in Illinois, including more than half who identified as pro-choice, want to keep this law in place. The abortion industry people keep conjuring up this image, which is actually false, and they are saying that it's putting young girls who may be in abusive households in the position of having to tell their parents. And that is not how the law works. The law requires the abortion industry, the abortionist or the abortion clinic, to notify the girl's parents, not the girl herself. It doesn't put that onus on the girl. The law puts the onus on the abortion industry. So they either have to notify via phone or they can even send a registered letter. And after 48 hours of waiting after sending that registered letter, they can consider that notice and the abortion can go forward. If you look at any of the websites for the abortion clinics in the state of Illinois, if you can click on the link if I'm a minor, and they very clearly spell it out. You know, we will send a letter to your parents, and even if your parents or your mom or your grandparent, whoever your guardian is, disagrees, that doesn't mean the abortion isn't going to go forward. We can still do the abortion. This is not parental consent. It is only parental notice. And when you look at all of the other things that parents have to get, not just notice for, but consent, you know, tattoos, ear piercings, medications in school, all of these things are, you know, the law has recognized the important role of the parents in knowing what's going on with their minor child. To exclude this, you know, as Dr. Bello said, she's infertile now because of her abortions. But, you know, you and I both know, as we're familiar with the pro-life movement, the number of, you know, post-abortive women who have all sorts of different, either physical or psychological or emotional complications after their abortions. Being a teenager is difficult enough. Not to let parents even know about this kind of extremely serious surgery. It can be, I mean, we know the case of Tanya Reeves, right, whose uterus was perforated while having a second trimester abortion at Planned Parenthood. Death isn't super common with abortion cases, but it happens. I have a friend who's an OBGYN who was on ER duty one weekend and told me he had a 15-year-old girl with sepsis come in. And when he examined her, found that she'd had an abortion a few days earlier. The abortionist had left parts of the unborn child's body, some fetal remains that were not completely removed, and she was septic. And he called the abortion clinic three times to try to get information on the surgery from the doctor who did the abortion. They never even called him back.
So here's the thing about this. I mean, you know, the popular support for this, the straightforward common sense of it, particularly when you compare it to, as you said, what is required, where parental consent is required and so many other procedures with respect to minors. And so this is just a case where it's a combination, as you said at the outset, of the money and the political power. And it has to be, it has to include, like we've seen with K through 12 education, parents that are willing to cede their sovereignty over their children to the experts in the K through 12, so-called, the experts in the K through 12 school system, and those from these ghoulish organizations like Planned Parenthood that present themselves as public health experts. That gets amplified, that impression gets amplified by the media, so they're supposed to be the good guys because the media says so and they say so, and any sort of conversation like we're having gets marginalized as much as possible.
Right. And, you know, and we know, too, when you look at just sort of the behavior of teenagers, and I know Amy talks about this a lot, you know, with her sons and how the COVID lockdown of schools has really affected, teenage suicide rates, et cetera, you know, we know from brain science, and we had a wonderful neurological psychologist who also testified at our press conference to keep the parental notice law in place. And she was talking about the brain development in teenagers and how the particular part of the brain that controls impulse and that allows the brain to contemplate the consequences, long-term consequences for certain choices and behaviors are not fully formed until you're probably in your early 20s, 22 through 23, 24, somewhere in there. So a teenager is not able physically, because of their brain development, to make a decision with life-altering consequences like an abortion. And again, we're not even talking about consent. The parents don't have to agree to, you know, the abortion clinic going forward with the procedure, but at least the parents can keep an eye on the girl to make sure, like, you know, the girl my friend saw in the emergency room, she doesn't become septic, she isn't suffering from suicidal ideation. That happens a lot with people who have had abortions, women who have had abortions, and that there aren't any other emotional consequences to the behavior. But, you know, I have heard now, as I've been debating this issue in multiple forums since the repeal was announced, the attempt to repeal was announced, you know, the abortion industry spokesperson saying the issue of sex trafficking is a red herring. And you talk about gaslighting people. You have victims like Brooke Bello who has testified. We have had sex trafficking experts from the State Department who presented, you know, academic information that shows that traffickers seek out states that don't have parental involvement laws for abortion. Of course they do. Why wouldn't they? And we know that every other state bordering Illinois, Wisconsin and Kentucky and Missouri and Iowa and Indiana all have some form of parental involvement with abortion. And for Illinois, then, to drop the last layer of protection that we have for minor girls in this state, from people who are predatory, from the abortion industry, which can also be predatory, and this is, it, like you said, it defies common sense.
Well, but, I mean, it's consistent, though. I mean, we're not interested in protecting girls playing sports, protecting girls in the privacy of the bathroom. We're not interested in protecting girls when it comes to a serious medical procedure like abortion. So they're nothing if not consistent in terms of their lack of interest in protecting young girls, which is just remarkable. I just go back. I thought Dr. Bello's question, why would you want to keep this a secret?
Right.
I don't think there's an answer to that question. I think that question should be repeated ad nauseum as this fight continues this month in the General Assembly. And so, oh, and by the way, just a little of a backstory on this, too. This parental notification law, which was passed during that very brief 2-year interregnum when Republicans had control of the House, 95 to 97, it took almost 2 decades to implement in.
Right, till 2003, yeah.
Or a decade, I should say, to implement, yeah. Because of the obstinance of the, you know, the political class, the attorney general, and so on and so forth. So, you know, passed in 95, signed into law then, took 8 years to implement. Then it's been a fight this entire time. Now they got super majorities and a pro-abortion governor, and they're moving to repeal it despite the popular support and the sense that it makes and the lives that have been saved as a result. It's incredible. It's also incredible that we're not hearing more about this. And so who are the partners supporting the opposition to this repeal? Why am I not hearing from pro-life legislators on this hue and cry throughout the state? The Catholic Conference, pro-life organizations, I mean, I've heard from some, but this should be something that you can't turn around without hearing.
Well, you're absolutely, I agree with you there. Every parent, you know, I have 3 teenage girls. I am terrified at what this might do to, you know, their girls in their peer group. You know, again, teenagers not necessarily known for making good decisions. They can act impulsively and irrationally at times, and that's just part of the maturation process. But, you know, at a time in Illinois and in other, you know, Democratic-run states when we are so focused on things like, you know, different sentencing guidelines, for example, for juvenile offenders, because we know that their brains operate the same way, right? Just what I said, impulse control and consequential behavior and long-term, you know, consequences. So we're willing to look at juvenile offenders, and there's a great effort, and I agree with it, you know, to protect juveniles from the same sentences that someone who should have known better would have had. So, but if we're going to offer that protection to juvenile offenders, why are we not offering it to young girls? We know that there's a significant percentage of young girls who are impregnated by men much older. So we're not even talking just about trafficking, but also a lot of statutory rape questions. And we know that clinics aren't always reporting, you know, sexual trafficking or certainly not, you know, when it's right within the statutory rape limitation, and girls can often be coerced. It's really rather shocking. And again, to your point, this should be front page news. I feel like I'm, you know, a voice crying in the wilderness a little bit. Now, the pro-life groups, we have really made an effort to make people aware of this. However, the abortion industry, the abortion lobby, is extremely powerful. And I think what they're trying to do, as they did with some of the other abortion bills in Illinois, is to kind of do a head fake, like, you know, we're going to drop it. In fact, I heard that on the news last week, that the bill wasn't going to go anywhere, it was going to be dropped. And then when was that vote taken on the big abortion change law in Illinois 2 years ago? It was the day before Memorial Day, on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock. That's what I'm afraid is going to happen, Dan. They're pretending right now, oh, you know, this isn't going to go anywhere. We don't really have the votes. And I hear that the lobbyists for the abortion industry, both from Planned Parenthood and from Personal PAC and the other groups, are working the phones really hard. And so we need to be equally involved and engaged. And that means calling your legislator. Even though you know your legislator is owned by Planned Parenthood, call them anyway. Because if there's enough heat, as you well know, and pressure put on these people, that this might just be, you know, a step too far even for Illinois. We cannot make Illinois the sex trafficking capital of the Midwest. You know, this is dangerous and reckless.
As I want to say, the bad news about the Illinois General Assembly is most of the people are cowards, and the good news is that most of the people are cowards. They respond to pressure, as you're saying, even those that are otherwise beholden and pathetic, which is most of them. House Bill 1797, Senate Bill 2190, oppose those bills. Call your legislator and tell him or her to oppose the repeal of parental notice for abortion. And you might put that question to whichever flunky in their office answers the phone. Why would this legislator want to keep something that could affect a girl's life for the rest of her life a secret? I think that's such a great frame on this.
Yep. And who does it benefit? Who benefits from this law being repealed? The abortion industry and sex traffickers. The girls and families and parents in Illinois don't benefit if this law is repealed. Is that who the Illinois General Assembly is working for? Abortion clinics here and then sex traffickers that bring, you know, minor girls here for abortions?
I mean, basically.
People are better than this. And we have a great website, Dan, saveparentalnotification.com. And all you have to do is put in your zip code. We'll tell you who your state legislators are and help you get an email or a phone call into them. But people, please, if you're listening, you've got to call your state legislator. You've got to put pressure on, or this is going to be, I think, another backdoor pass of a bill and that everyone will come to regret later.
SaveParentalNotification.com is the website. Mary Fiorito, spokesperson for Parents for the Protection of Girls. Mary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
She joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.